Tihi Cycle of Ni Society 195. Bination W ith form, life animates form to a certain degree. Conversely, form is an impediment to the flow of life. The result is that physical manifestation is a paradoxical state where in life appears less than itself and matter more than itself. At death, form reverts to its natural state of inertia, while life returns to its normal condition of uninterrupted flow. In his treatise, On the Wanderings of Ulysses, Thomas Taylor, drawing upon De Ulixis Auroribus, the work of an anonymous Greek writer, declares that Homer used the Trojan War as a symbol of the battle between the rational faculties, the Greeks, and the irrational faculties, the Trojans. Thomas Taylor notes that Homer is reputed to have been blind, because, as Proclus observes, he separated himself from sensible beauty, and extended the intellect of his soul to invisible and true harmony. He was said, therefore, to be blind because that intellectual beauty to which he raised himself cannot be perceived by corporeal eyes. In the 13th book of the Odyssey, Homer describes in veiled language a mysterious cave by which the Orphic philosophy concerning the mystery of life and death is obscurely set forth. High at the head a branching olive grows and crowns the pointed cliffs with shady boughs. A cavern pleasant, though involved in night. Beneath it lies the Naiades' delight, where bowls and urns of workmanship divine and massy beams in native marble shine, on which the nymphs' amazing webs display or purple hue, an exquisite array. The busy bees within the urn secure honey delicious, and like nectar pure. Perpetual waters through the grotto glide. A lofty gate unfolds on either side, that to the north is pervious to mankind. The sacred south to immortals is consigned. In his essay on the Cape of the Nymphs, Porphyry discusses at some length the occult significance of Homer's cavern. The gist of Porphyry's conclusions, which he derives from various ancient authors, Egyptian, Greek, and Persian, is as follows. The ancients consecrated caves as symbols of the world in that, like the world, they were produced from an internal and not an external cause. The Persian mystics signified the descent of the soul into the sublunary regions, and its regression therefrom, by initiating their mystics in caverns, as temples, groves, and altars were established in honor of the gods, so grottos were also dedicated to the nymphs, or naiades, because of the water which trickled down the walls. In the 7th book of his Republic, Plato writes, "Behold men as if dwelling in a subterranean cavern, and in a den-like habitation, whose entrance is widely expanded to the admission of the light through the whole cave." The ancient theologists considered caverns as appropriate symbols of mundane powers and of the sensible world, because these rocky openings are dark, stony, and humid. Furthermore, the dampness existing in the cave was analogous to the humid ity of the world, which the Greeks conceived to be indispensable to the generation of souls. The soul may be platonically defined as the first of bodies and the individualized source of bodily life. Heraclitus says that moisture appears delightful and not deadly to souls. The etheric humidity which incarnating souls find indispensable to their bodybuilding processes caused the philosophers to declare that these souls must be profoundly steeped or drenched in moisture as they enter into the sphere of generation. But pure souls do not desire to generate and hence absent themselves from the sphere of humidity, which causes Heraclitus to remark, "A dry soul is the wisest." Porphyry then declares that souls proceeding into generation and enveloped in this ethereal mixture arc properly called naiades. The naiades are nymphs, presumably water spirits. and their esoteric meaning as given above was revealed only to the initiated. The cavern is therefore a temple sacred to the processes of generation and signifies not only the world in which generated souls reside, but, although Porphyry does not bring out the fact, also the womb from which the philosophic elect are liberated by the second birth. The bowls and urns. 196 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Tihi Cycle of NE Society 197. Which, according to Homer, are contained in the cave, are not only appropriate emblems of the aquatic nymphs but are also symbols of Bacchus, and being composed of baked earth signify the bodies into which the corporeal souls descend. Here we have the vessels of various shapes which Omar Khayyam refers to in his Rubaiyat. Homer then describes the purple webs which the nymphs weave on marble looms. The spinning of the web represents the building of the fleshly body with its arteries, veins, nerves, and muscles upon the shining framework of the bones. This is the garment with which the incarnating soul is to be invested, but which, alas, is to prove a net to ensnare and hold captive the rational virtues. The heavens are called a veil by the inscience, by whom they are regarded as the vestments of the celestial gods. The honey which the busy bees store away in the bowls and amphorae has two significances. Honey was regarded by the ancients as both a preservative and also a purifier. The Persians used honey in their sacrifices as a symbol of the pre-serving and defending powers. Honey further signifies mortal and transitory pleasure as distinguished from divine and enduring pleasure. In the ancient mythology, Saturn, being intoxicated with honey, sleeps, and while in this condition is robbed of his empire by Jupiter. This fable obscurely intimates that the soul is robbed of its divinity when it becomes intoxicated by the illusionary happiness of the corporeal sphere. Porphyry also gives a third interpretation to honey, which he declares was used to signify death, an interpretation dependent upon the previous assumption that it befuddled the divine perceptions. Gall he declares to be a symbol of life, adding, in comparing the two, that the life of the soul dies through pleasure, honey, but through bitterness, gall, the soul resumes its life. Bees, here termed the ox begotten, are symbols of just souls entering into generation both because of their indus try and because they instinctively return to that place from which they first came, for the just soul instinctively returns to its divine and unlimited condition. In his Scholia on the Phaedrus of Plato, Hermias declares that the nectar and ambrosia of the gods are to be understood as possessing a profound philosophic meaning. He writes, ambrosia is analogous to dry nutriment and on this account it signifies an establishment in causes, but nectar is analogous to moist food and signifies the providential attention of the gods to secondary natures. Referring to the gates leading into and out of the cavern, Porphyry declares them to represent the winter and summer solstices, Capricorn and Cancer respectively, adding that as Cancer is nearest to us, it is very properly attributed to the moon, which is the nearest of the heavenly bodies to the earth, but as the southern pole by its distance is invisible to us, Capricorn is attributed to Saturn, the most remote of the planets. The Orphic theologists add that Cancer is the gate through which souls descend into generation, and Capricorn the gate through which they ascend again, in that the north is appropriate to descend but the south to ascend. The north gate of the cavern is therefore said to be pervious to the descent of men, but the south gate is called the avenue not of the gods but of souls, the immortals ascending to the gods. The ancients likewise connected the winds with souls proceeding into generation or escaping therefrom, declaring that the north winds aid genera shen and refresh the dying, but the south winds dissolve life. But one symbol remains to be explained, namely, the branch ing olive that grows above the cave. The olive is the plant of Minerva, and Minerva having been produced from the head of Jupiter is the proper symbol of wisdom. It was customary to place this plant over the gates and arches to signify that the universe, the world symbolized by the cavern, is not the product of casual effort or the work of irrational fortune, but the offspring of an intellectual nature and a divine wisdom. The olive is also the plant with which the victor in the race of life is crowned, thus revealing the mystic fact that he who vanquishes or outruns his lesser nature will be rewarded with wisdom's crown. 198 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Tihi Cycle of NE Society 199. The cycle of necessity is the term applied to that period or condition through which man must pass in the attainment of conscious immortality, conscious in the sense of illumined realization as distinguished from that immortality of which we all partake in common but which remains unrecognized until philosophic perception grasps its true import. In his pilgrim age to the holy city, man must pass through the valley called Jehoshaphat, or the place of dry bones. Here grisly specters rise from their moss-grown sarcophagi to perform the weird gyrations of the dance of death. Every gesture of the irrational life is part of a ghastly pageantry, for the cradle stands within the open grave. Philosophy alone can bestow upon man the precious gift of immortality, for though every human soul is innately divine and beyond dissolution, it cannot partake of its own permanence without those perceptions which philosophy must confer. As long as man believes in death, there is no life, and what man affirms to be existence is actually the gloomy vestibule of oblivion. Buddhism became the faith of half the world because it assured man that death was but a dream and mortality an empty lie. The power exercised by Christianity over the Western Hemisphere results in great measure from its claim that for those of sufficient faith death has been forever vanquished by the resurrection of the Holy Nazarene. It is not sufficient, however, that man be simply immortal. For immortality is merely the means to an end, the infinite opportunity for achievement of ultimate perfection. It is not sufficient that man go on living after he is dead, for this would only perpetuate on a more attenuated sphere the miseries of his present state. Nor is it reasonable to presume that the phenomenon of death can produce any definite cultural results. Theology fails to interest the modern mind because it postulates an after-death state which is but small improvement over corporeal conditions. What shall it profit a man if he leave a static earth to wander around in a static heaven? Yet philosophically, theology is nearly correct in its depiction of the so-called celestial state, for heaven is an attenuated earth where life comes